Hello and welcome to Spiritually Hungry. Today we're so excited to be in conversation with Ainsley MacLeod, a past life psychic who helps souls uncover their life purpose. Ainsley has helped thousands of clients experience positive changes in their lives. And listeners know, I'm all about change. Ainsley is also the author of the book, The Instruction, Living the Life Your Soul Intended, as well as two other great reads, The Old Soul's Guidebook and The Transformation. His books outline his method for identifying the level of your soul, where it's at, and how to understand your purpose so you can heal in this lifetime. Please welcome Ainsley MacLeod. We're so happy to have you.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
You are the author of a few books. We've read through some of them. I think that what I found so much of what you said interesting, but I think what made me take pause is how in your first book, The Instruction, Living the Life Your Soul Intended, the opening chapter, you talk about your life, and it seems very different than the one that you're leading now. So I thought that was really interesting because as you, and I want you to go through the different levels of soul and the types of souls, but often one thinks that if a person ends up living a really purpose-filled life or a spiritual life or a life of very clear, specific purpose of helping other people, the way that you talk about your life before you found this seems quite different. So can you talk about that and how you kind of went from that first phase of your life into what you're doing today?
Yeah, that's a good question because it does seem like it feels like I had two different lives. You know, there was really the life before I had a kind of, you know, like opening to spirit and sort of really figuring out my purpose. Not that I wasn't purpose driven before that, but I grew up in Scotland. I was an artist for I went to art school. I became an art director and then became an illustrator, cartoon illustrator. So I did that for about 20 years. And then I got to a point where I was just sort of burned out doing that kind of work. And I was an atheist for most of my life, but I was an atheist who also was fascinated by psychics. And I'd had a lot of interactions with psychics from probably about my late 20s. I first went to see a psychic to debunk her and came out with my hair standing on end and going, how the heck did she know all of that? So it sort of really opened my eyes to that sort of potential. I didn't do anything with it for quite a few years. And then I had a major life change. So we're like a big, you know, breakup. And I relocated. At that point, I'd moved to the States and I was on the East Coast and then moved to the West Coast just for convenience because an apartment came up. And the interesting thing was it turned out to be fulfilling a prophecy from a psychic from about a decade before. It's a guy in Brighton in England. He told me that I would end up in California and there was nothing I could do about it. And I never thought about fulfilling the prophecy or, you know, making it work. And just suddenly on the first night there, I actually meditated for the first time in years. I'd been just living a very stressful life. And I had this moment where this guy's voice came to me. Not, it didn't feel like it was in my head. It felt like it was in the room. Just that thing about you're going to end up in California. There's nothing you can do about it. And it sort of woke me out of my slumber. The next day I bought a pile of spiritual books. And what I was trying to do is figure out how could a psychic know that, you know, with no effort on my part, that or not deliberately trying to make this thing work, that I ended up there. And that got me onto the path. And then I had a couple of more epiphanies, one where I ran into my deceased uncle. I talk about this in the book. It was that was really the biggest thing that got me on the path. I was in Hawaii on a trip and I'd heard from many psychics, actually, I think about four psychics had actually named my uncle. And the skeptic in me was going, yeah, everybody's got an Uncle John. But he showed up in a bookstore And just, I mean, he was there for about a second. He'd been dead for a good 10 years, I think. And he was just about 18 inches away from me, very clear, like real, but just there and gone, but with a longer message about working together. So that was what got me started on the path of doing psychic work, was just kind of going, okay, you want to talk to me? Let's talk. So, yeah, so basically, I went from being this atheist, kind of complete non-believer, kind of bumbling through life a little bit, to suddenly having this, epiphany, and like a quick complete shift. And I've gone from being an atheist to somebody who talks to the spirit world every day. And
Were you
so it's
frightened when you had their first encounter with a spirit?
no,
You were not.
no, not at all. No, it didn't feel frightening whatsoever. I mean, when I ran into my uncle, it was just like, oh, right. Oh, this is cool. So when I first started working with spirit guides, no, I can't say there was ever any fear came up. There was a lot of frustration because, I'd been told I was psychic for years before I had that epiphany, and I never felt it. I mean, I used to go and see this psychic lady in London, and she would always tell me how psychic I was, and I would always just say, well, if I was psychic, I wouldn't be paying you, I'd be doing it myself. And we'd have a joke about that. But and another weird thing was that I psychics would tell me that you're psychic. I mean, even in public places, I had a lady in Gatwick Airport. She was telling me, I'm psychic, and my spirit guides are telling me that you need to be doing psychic work. And her husband is sitting beside her, completely mortified and disparaging. He kept going, oh, I'm sorry about the mumbo jumbo. Sorry about my wife. I'm going, no, it's cool. This is fascinating. Literally, I was approached twice in London pubs with the same sort of message. I was just very slow in doing anything about it. I just really didn't know how to begin, and it was just finally just. I was living a more tranquil life at the point that when I went to Hawaii, at the time I was living in a houseboat in Sausalito, California, and it was very quiet. And it was the first time in my life that I'd had really any peace. Everything had been throughout my life had been very high energy, and always dealing with drama and stuff.
Yeah, I
And
read about some of that in the book. It was
it
almost
was crazy.
like,
I mean, when I look back on it, it was just like, oh my God, no wonder I couldn't access my
yeah,
psychic
because it's so
ability.
extreme, being an atheist, and then some of the choices you made, in your own words in your book, about the partners that you chose, and like it was like choosing chaos almost. Do you think that that was a subconscious way to avoid your calling in a way?
I think I certainly was resistant to going within. I'd been a very introspective child, and somewhere along the line, I picked up the sort of message that there was something wrong with that. A lot of people saying, "Oh, you need to get out of yourself," and I thought, and I was always criticized for being too sensitive. I grew up with an angry, narcissistic, alcoholic father. And I think one of the things I've noticed this in people who are kind of overtly psychic or doing that kind of work is often having chaos in the family of origin and going within, so that allows you to develop a connection with the spirit world. But then after that, what I just well I kept marrying my father,
Yeah,
just
that's
it's what I knew. Honestly, it was it sounds crazy, but it was my normal. It was just, just being abused.
So
Basically, that was just what I was used to.
you talk about healing, getting indications of past lives so that you can heal. Did you have that? Oh, I want to hear about that process, but also, did you have that with your father? Did you see past lifetimes that you had with him specifically?
That's a really good question. I've never looked at a past life with my dad or any of his past lives. I think that's really good. Well, that's one for me to. It's a funny
You
thing that when I
still
first started talking to the spirit world, I spent actually 3 years talking to my spirit guides. My uncle, he very quickly passed me on to spirit guides that I work with now. And I spent 3 years practicing and talking to them, and you know, every available moment I was asking questions about history, geography, checking out things online, to a point where the spirit world is kind of going, are you ever going to get out and do something with this? My concern was more like a fear that I would screw something up, you know, like give somebody bum information and it would, you know, the next thing I'm responsible for some tragedy. So I had to do some past life work around that myself. In fact, I had to do quite a lot of past life work to be able to do what I do. I mean, if, for example, I had past life where I was judged and executed. And that sort of thing doesn't have to be exactly that, but where judgment leads to death, could be, you know, for the color of your skin, for in a court of law or whatever, it creates a fear of, or death-related fear of judgment. My spirit guides would call that a phobia, just because it's specifically death-related. And how it showed up for me was extreme fear around public speaking. And I mean, I literally went 30 years without talking in public. I mean, I'd had to bail out of so many meetings, and sometimes I couldn't even talk to one person. It was debilitating. And I had tried everything, you know, hypnotism. And, well, when I say tried everything, one thing I hadn't tried was past life work. And so when I was writing my first book, my spirit guides took me aside and said, you know, you can't write a book and then not talk about it. No, I was actually praying for failure. I was kind of hoping it wouldn't sell. I wouldn't have to do interviews and that sort of thing. And I was realizing myself, yeah, this is a little bit messed up, you know. So I had to work through some fears like that. And that really has allowed me. I mean, the incredible healing you get from doing past life work is amazing. I mean, it's just, I see it all the time in people
so how
I work
do
with.
You so you talked about that your uncle was your spirit guide. You have, I want to know, do you have different ones now, and how do you connect that to them and find them, number one? And the second part of that question is, how do you find your past lives? I've had personal experiences where I've seen three or four past lives, maybe five. I asked this question about my father specifically, your father, because it's my father's day of elevation today, actually. And I actually just feel him around. And I've seen lifetimes with him. Once he passed, it became clear, not when he was still living. So I'm curious about that process.
Yeah, well, you know, I only worked with my uncle for like a day or two. I can't remember, maybe it's just a, you know, a couple of sessions, but he passed me over to the guides. At least my spirit guides morph and change. So, you know, I can't say it's exactly the same guides, but they are on the same level. And I you know, I just developed a method for working with them. And in fact, it wasn't even clear to begin with what would be the method. Well, you know, would I be clairaudient, clairvoyant, or whatever? So we kind of cycled through all the different clairs to figure out what worked best, and really settled on it's a more sort of clairaudient kind of thing. It's not like a voice in the ear kind of thing, but it's certainly, and it's, well, super hard to explain, but I get whole sentences, and in that moment there's nothing else in my head, you know. So what I worked on with my spirit guides was, you know, developing like a vocabulary. So, you know, they don't have to give me 1,000 words every time to explain something that's maybe a common thing that people are dealing with. So we have code words and expressions and things that I know exactly what they mean when they bring up a certain word. Like, for example, if my spirit guides just suddenly throw out the word beauty, I know exactly what that means. That means that somebody has had a past life, probably of imprisonment or enslavement, or maybe down a mine or something, where they were denied natural beauty or color or whatever. And in this life, they're going to have a heightened appreciation of natural beauty, often a heightened appreciation of flowers and plants, and sometimes just having nice clothes, nice color on the walls, that sort of thing. It's just karmically balancing the effect of one life against another. So you denied it in one life, and then the karmic pendulum swings, and you really want to have color and nature and so on.
So you, if that word comes to you, then that's what that means for whoever you're sitting with, or so your spirit guides speak to you, or do you need that person's spirit guides to come? Do they come to you as well?
It's a good question, because the people ask me that quite a lot. And my spirit guides just say, look, don't worry about it. But, you know, we handle this. Well, what they say is it's like everything they talk about that happens in spirit, they have to use metaphors, because everything's happening energetically. So these are just convenient terms and ways for us to understand. So they say the simplest way of understanding it is that my spirit guides talk to your spirit guides and, you know, figure out whatever needs to be done. So I'm not talking to somebody else's spirit guides. I'm talking to mine. And that's, like I say, we've got a kind of language that we speak. Mostly it's just straightforward. And mostly, like I said, it was in full sentences. But there are these common things that come up. So we have little expressions, and it saves me sitting around for 5 minutes channeling something when I know exactly what their meaning.
So I want to let Michael ask a question. I have one more question on this, in this vein. I heard you say that just because something is spirited doesn't mean they're spiritual. So how can you identify if a energy that's coming to you or a guide is positive or negative? And have you ever had to push somebody, you know, something away because it wasn't a positive force?
Yeah. I was quite embarrassed about it, because I had been working with my spirit guides for a while. I mean, it was months, not years. And one time I got this, what I learned later was a mischievous astral plane entity. I mean, you can't be hurt by, you know, those in spirit. I mean, people can be freaked out by it, but they don't have the power to hurt you, but they can really mess with you. So this spirit guy said, came in, and so, you know, it's just like one morning I sort of like check in, and then this spirit has, you know, come in and said, oh, you know, I'm the guy, you know, I'm going to be the main guy now. And it's so embarrassing to talk about, because I was quite flattered. Oh, really? Oh, that's great. I got special treatment or something. And so we got talking, and this spirit guide, which wasn't a guide at all, but said, do you know what a trifecta is? And I'm going, no, I've never heard of it. And do you know what a perfecta is? And I'm going, no. I said, do you know what a daily double is? I'm going, no, I have no idea. Well, it turned out to be horse racing terms. And then this entity goes, well, I'm really embarrassed to do that, but I fell for it. I need you to take me to the track. I loved going to the track when I've never been to, or never at that point been to horse races. So the spirit wanted to go to the track, and actually went. I mean, thank goodness I left my credit card behind. I mean, deliberately. I said, okay, I've got $10 in my pocket. That's all I'm prepared to bet at the track. So it's my first time there. So I basically get advice from this spirit about horses to choose, which is great. First two horses romped home first and second, and then the third race, you know, I'm going, oh, this is great. I bet my last $5 or whatever on this one, and it, you know, fell at the first fence or whatever. I mean, it sort of came sort of trotting in like an hour after all the other horses, and I'm going, I feel I've been hoodwinked. And then I realized, you know, I really had. It was like, this is not a spirit guide. But to a bigger point, it is really, it's a matter of discerning the voice, you know. Like, it would never happen now, because I could tell immediately, just from experience, I mean, after 25 years, I can tell when I'm talking to my spirit guides. And I really don't get, I can't remember the last time I had interference from the other side, but it happened a lot more back in the very early days. And so I always do a lot of protective work, you know, like, you know, making sure my spirit guides are there and protecting me while I do any kind of work, any spiritual work. And that seems to have done the trick.
Do you need to ask for permission?
I think for a lot of people, they, you know, I've had clients who say, my spirit guides tell me such and such. And I go, are you sure that they're spirit guides? Like, you know, like you were saying, quoting me, not everyone in spirit is spiritual. You know, like to my spirit guides once said, there are jerks on this plane and there are jerks on the astral plane as well.
So I want to, when you today hear from the spirit guides, do you have to prepare yourself or they're just there whenever you call? Do you call them? What does that process work like today for you?
Yeah, I switch on and off because there's quite a big energy exchange. And so, you know, I discovered very, very early on doing this stuff that I had to bring them in and send them away really. When I was done, so I'm not dragging that. I mean, I would finish doing a couple of sessions, go to the coffee shop, and even people would look at me and go, are you okay? And I go, oh yeah, I need to switch my spirit guides off. I'm still, you know, halfway between this plane and the other. So what I do is every morning, I have a little ritual I go through with my spirit guides where I ask for protection. I ask for them to, you know, make sure that every bit of information is for the highest possible good and for everybody concerned, and keep any of those, you know, mischievous entities away from me. And and then before each session, I always make sure, you know, I bring spirit guides in and make sure that they acknowledge the person I'm about to work with, that we are suitable for each other, that there's no blocks or anything. And you know, and again, more requests for protection and to ensure the information is accurate.
So, have you ever turned anybody away once you started to work with them or read them? Did you ever have to?
Yeah, I've had a few of those. I mean, not a lot. I mean, I have to say, you know, 99.9% of the time, everything just goes great, and you know, it's wonderful. But yeah, I've had a few people. I mean, I had somebody who oh my God, it sounds terrible, but she was very, very whiny. And every time I answered a question, she's like, yeah, but that's not what I wanted to know. I wanted to know this. It was like this moving goalpost. And eventually, I was 55 minutes into a 60-minute session, and I just went, you know what? That's it. I'm giving you your money back. Don't ever call me again. It was just like, oh my God. And I've had a few people I've had to slap down, you know, basically, no, you are not going to get the chance to work with me again, you know. So, but, you know, very, very few and far between. But, you know, sometimes people have like a mental illness or, in fact, one thing I noticed was, I hasn't happened for a long time, but several times where I'd be about to work with somebody and the spirit guides could go, look, give it 2 weeks. And I go, well, it happened enough that I would be able to say to somebody, have you just changed your meds? And they go, oh yeah. How do you know? It's like, well, you know, we need to give it a couple of weeks for something to settle in. And there are certainly times when, well, when it happened, it's probably about a year ago now, where I usually check at the beginning of every week. I usually go through whoever's on the calendar, make sure I can work with them. And I forgot to do it. And I started talking to this young woman. And I said, okay, well, let's make sure the guides acknowledge you. And they said, absolutely can't work with her. Just, it's not supported. And of course, then there's nothing I can do. I mean, I'm just the messenger. So I told her, I'm really sorry. You know, I'll just give you a refund. And apparently we're just not supported in working together. That was all. She went absolutely ballistic. not only is she going nuts and telling me this is the most unprofessional thing she's ever come across in her entire life, her mother gets involved, and she's kind of like, she's, you know, calling or texting or emailing, and you know, this is outrageous. My daughter and I are furious. And it was like, I think you two are making the point. You know, I think maybe this is why the spirit guides didn't want us working together.
It probably scared her, like, what's wrong with me that I can't see into, you know,
yeah.
Which is a human response.
It is. And what I've always said to somebody when this happens, look, you know, this is not a sign of any bad news. Right. It's not like they can't read you because you're going to die in a horrible fiery car crash tomorrow or something. It's just usually incompatibility.
Right.
One of the really interesting things in reading your book is that, you know, we study Kabbalah and ancient spiritual wisdom, is that so much of what you write about, it correlates to a lot of what we've studied. So I wonder maybe if you can share with our listeners the idea that you write that most of the souls are between 5,000 to 6,000 years old, and maybe the chronology of that starting from 55,000 years ago till why souls as we know them individually really began around 5,000 to 6,000 years ago.
Yes. So we humans got this kind of upgraded soul, if you like, en masse, I mean, all of us, about 55,000 years ago. And that's what really put us on a slow trajectory, you know. I mean, we were just bumbling along. It was like, you know, we were growing up until that point, but we didn't have the kind of souls that we have now. But 55,000 years ago, we get these souls, and then we gradually start to become, you know, a hockey stick graph of progress. We become the creatures of reason and creativity that we are now. And for most of us, we've been on for old souls, you know, to get through how many. Usually a soul will want to get through something. The average would be like 110 or 120 lifetimes to get all the experience that you want. It's actually quite hard to really get an accurate number because the spirit guides would not generally count a life where you died a month old or something. You know, so much infant mortality in the past that, you know, at what point do you start considering it an incarnation? So, you know, it could be a lot more than 120, but these would be short lives that never really got the chance to go anywhere, you know, so it might be a lot more. But it will usually take you about somewhere between 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 years to get from life number one to wherever you need to end. So most old souls on the planet, I mean, the oldest old souls probably would, you know, could have been here for about 7,000 years. But that's amazing because it does take you from Stone Age right through to, you know, the modern world that we live in. One of the things that came with this soul, the level of soul that we got, they could call it a stage three soul, is that it did give us more individuality. And there's some, you know, benefits and some downsides to that as well. We lost a little bit of our connection to one another. But also what we recognized then was that we had different soul types. We had different personalities. And this was something that was actually more clear, you know, a few thousand years ago than it would be in the modern world. Because it's what really helped to make these more tribal type lives successful, was that everybody had a purpose. You know, the leaders were there to lead. I'm a creator type. People like me were busy cave painting and doing creative stuff back then. You know, thinkers were the storytellers or the tribal intellectuals and so on. So there's all these soul types, that these personality types that are developed over lifetimes. And you'll see it in people now. In fact, I just did a Q&A in our membership program, and somebody asked about this, and you'll see themes going from this life to others. I mean, it'll be things like somebody comes into this life to be a doctor. Well, they might well choose a family of doctors to come into because they'll get the encouragement or maybe even expectation that they'll go into medicine. But when I look at the past lives, I'll find multiple lives going back as healers. You know, last life might have been an acupuncturist, the one before that maybe an herbalist, and maybe a surgeon before that. But you get these themes, and especially the older the soul gets, the more it does tend to follow these themes. Younger souls tend to just jump all over the place just for any experience, but the older soul goes, well, I'm on this track where I'm really learning about healing and helping others. I had a weird one the other day where I was talking to somebody, I was telling her about a past life where she'd been a roofer and fell, and you know, a typical thing would be, well, it's going to be a fear of heights there. But she actually laughed and said, you won't believe this, but every male in my family is a roofer. Now, I mean, that one is just plain weird, but I don't think it's a coincidence either.
I was going to ask, you explained the idea of a life plan, right? That our soul, maybe you could share with our listeners, before it comes into this world, literally maps out the life that it needs to have or is meant to have.
We all come in with a life plan. The thing about the life plan is that it's not carved in stone and it's not massively detailed. It's a broad outline for the life. So it includes things like your location, you know, place of your birth, maybe places you want to visit, people you want to interact with, experiences that you want to have, fears that you want to overcome, and maybe challenges that you set up. It can be, you know, work that you want to have, and the soul will choose appropriate talents and abilities from past lives as well, and an appropriate personality. In my last book, the Old Soul's Guidebook, I have a section. It's about climbing Mount Everest in flip flops. And the point being that you wouldn't climb Mount Everest in flip-flops. You would use proper climbing gear. And the same thing applies to the personality that you choose for this life. You choose one that's going to be appropriate for the experiences that you want to have. So, you know, you wouldn't, if you wanted to be a professional boxer, you wouldn't choose to be a nurturing caregiver soul type. I mean, it'd be totally inappropriate for the journey ahead. So all of that sort of thing is chosen. Entire personality is chosen. And that's one of the, you know, things I love looking at. I took a moment to look at both of you and get some sense of what you're about. If you're interested.
Sure, absolutely. Absolutely.
I had a feeling you were going to do that, actually.
I gotta tell you, this is something that fascinates me, is that when my last book, the Old Soul's Guidebook, came out, I did something like, I mean, it must have been about 40 or 50 podcast interviews, well, you know, over like maybe a year or something. And I would do just little mini readings, you know, just to check in 10 minutes before with the spirit guides. And what I found was that every single podcaster, and it includes you two, is working through a past life fear of rejection. And this comes from maybe dying alone or being abandoned by a mom or something in a past life. And it creates for old souls often a feeling of being a little bit on the outside looking in, you know, like not fitting into the mainstream. But there are three ways actually to heal the fear. One is to do the past life work. Second way would be to belong. You know, if you can belong and not get rejected, that's great. But what I would call the elevated way to do this is to unite others. And that's what, as podcasters, you're doing. You're bringing people in to make them feel like they belong. It's like creating your own family. It's like being a Pied Piper in a way. And so I was delighted to find that both of you are working on that. Another thing that is very interesting is that you both are very similar in terms of your personality, but the elements are in slightly different, different order. But you're two very strong-minded people. You're also both very intellectually centered as well. I would imagine that you both have a tendency to overthink things. Would that be right?
Yes.
Yes, certainly.
So far, you're on the money.
Don't overthink the answer to that question.
No, so the answer is yes. I think we work on not overthinking, but yes.
So yes, it's something to, well, because part of the journey for you both is to learn to really use your intuition. So it is something you have to make sure that you get over, you know, like it's easier just with time and experience, you know, when you have, you know, the evidence to see that, you know, there's times that I wish I'd listened to my intuition. There's times I did, and I'm so glad I did. All these things build confidence in your intuition and start to get over that tendency to think, oh, it's probably just my imagination, or, you know, did I really get that right? Interestingly, you're both at the same soul age, 13 soul ages, you two are both 80% into level 9.
I was, you know, I read the ages, and I read how you should meditate, and then of course we're always in a rush doing many things. I figured we were a 9. There's 10. Can you just explain for our listeners? I went through it. I thought it was really interesting. Briefly, you know, each kind of stage, and then there's a positive and a negative to each one, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, from stages 1 to 5, you're a young soul and gradually learning to be what it's like to be a human and in the world. And by the time you get to level 5, you're pushing outward. And, you know, like talking of the negative and positive, the positive aspect of being a level 5 soul is supposed to be exploration and really learning about the world and, you know, broadening your horizons and so on. But it slips into exploitation, which is why you get things like the world the way it is, you know, or, you know, imperialism and all that sort of thing. Older souls, there's a flip at the end of level 5 where you go from an outward focus to an inward focus. So it's more introspective. And that's one of the signs of being an older soul. And by the time you get up to level 9, where you guys are, well, you're at the end of level 9. So there's certain things that every level 9 soul would have. And one of them is you want your life to have meaning, has to have a sense of strong purpose. And almost always that meaning comes from helping others in some way. And you're both exactly the same point. Both, this is where, you know, everybody at this point has to work through that fear of rejection. So that's it's kind of a shared experience that you would have. And sometimes when you have couples coming together to work on that, you form a very solid bond, because obviously you don't want to be rejected and you don't want to reject your partner. So you want to make, you know, you want both to feel very safe in the relationship. And, you know, trust can be a part of that. It's also very much related to the heart chakra and learning really to feel safe, to open up and love and be loved. There's also at this elevated point that you're at, you know, you're down to the wire, you've got a few lifetimes ahead of you, not much. You know, you want to get it right. You want to be doing the right thing. You don't want to waste a life. It's got to feel like there's a higher purpose. Both of you have what's called a desire for immortality, which doesn't mean you want to live forever, but it means you want to leave a legacy or create a ripple effect. Most commonly what people do is write a book. That's, you know, I think 9 times out of 10, that's the way people express that. But there's loads of other ways to do it. As long as you're, you know, influencing people way, way beyond this moment, you know, maybe even beyond your time here. That's why books are such a common way of expressing this. Interestingly, you both have a leader influence in your soul types. You're both spiritualists, spiritual soul types. This will give you an interest in spirituality. And really wanting to make, again, I often use the same terms to describe both level 9 and the spiritualist soul type, meaning, purpose, and so on. So it often, on a very practical level, is to prevent you from just taking any old job and just go, well, you know, I don't like my job, but at least I get paid. That never works for souls of your age, because so much more of that sense, like, I'm here for a purpose and I got to be making a difference. Also, you don't want to waste time. Well, that actually shows up. Let me just refer to my notes here. So you both have the same elements, but they are in a very different order. So both of you are very, very intellectually centered. Both of you should be generally note takers. You need to write things down to process. And, you know, when I'm talking to it, I'm doing a session with people like you, people who have this, you know, super intellectual aspect to them, I often joke about how they should at the end have about 20 pages of notes. And if they don't, sit them back down and figure out what the problem is. They also, I joke about how they turn up at my live events and I can spot them in the audience because they look like court stenographers writing down everything that I say. But it's just like, it's how you're meant to process. So journaling, super important for both of you. You both have a leader in you, which is interesting. So you will, you know, you both, the reason for choosing a leader at this soul age, you know, you've obviously had lifetimes as a leader. It could be lead a corporation, or you could lead an army. I mean, it's just anything. You could be a band leader or whatever, but you have to learn to use your authority. And the interesting thing is that it can sometimes cause a butting of heads, but more often than not, it creates a sense of shared goals, because this aspect of you is that you both have is about goals and achieving things. I actually call it Viagra for the soul, choosing this, because you know, if you get to an old soul, there's this thing called old soul fatigue, you know, it's like, oh God, I've been around the block so many times and here I am back on earth. Oh God, I don't feel like doing anything. And this helps to sort of, you know, get that energy back to do things. Both of you have the creator and performer in there as well. A lot of need for creative thought, a huge need for autonomy for both of you. It looks like for both of you, freedom, personal freedom, that sort of thing is going to be really, really important. You have a lot of the characteristics that I would see in people who are self-employed. You know, you've got the don't fence me in, don't tell me what to do thing. And you just need the opportunity for personal freedom and finding your own way to, you know, achieve whatever goals. Last thing you want to do is have somebody control you or tell you what to do. I've got a past life. I have a past life for both of you. So again, I'm going to have to refer to my notes here. So Monica, there was two major lessons related to this past life. One was about that desire for immortality, because there's something here about you didn't get the chance to do all that you were meant to do. And the other thing is about being you. Now, that's a typical, I mean, it's not an uncommon thing to have as a goal, you know, to really be yourself in this life. But the reason for you wanting to be yourself is astonishing. So this past life was in Germany. From the context I was getting, it looks like 20th century. You were raised as a boy. You had parents who wanted a boy, but you were actually a girl. And it got to a point where, like, there was so much friction here, and I'm surprised it didn't happen earlier, but you were 20 years old when you just went, this is ridiculous, and you went off to Leipzig, I think they said it was. You went, so anyway, I don't know where you started off, but so you went somewhere else in that sort of part of Europe, but really reinvented yourself back as the person that you were really meant to be. So you ended up in a lab. You were you had a research position in a lab. One of the things that you encountered was your efforts, things that you were responsible for developing or creating, was actually stolen by men, or you know, or guys took credit for something that you as a woman had done. And so, you know, that's going to give you, I would have thought in this life, some pretty strong, you know, strong feminist part to you as well. And along with that is this need for, I would imagine, like, you know, wanting credit where credit's due as well. Let me see if there's anything else to that life as well. Oh yeah, they described you as very competitive and arrogant in that past life, and then they used the word prickly.
Which word?
You had no
prickly.
They said you were prickly and you had no real friends. So how that's going to show up in this life, because there's, again, this karmic pendulum swinging. You're going to be more, through that performer in your soul types, probably, you know, more of a people person and more, a little bit more perhaps diplomatic and gentler in how you approach people. I don't know if any of that makes sense, but...
No, it's interesting. I have a question.
Be loved.
Did my spirit guides come and tell you this? Or
well, what? I just picked this up for all my spirit guides told me. So
Yeah, basically so, everything you said are things that I have felt for sure, you know, always. Like I always said when I was little, I felt like I didn't quite belong. And I remember feeling like a prop almost, like I wasn't really seen. And I've spoken to my parents about this. And like, I showed them home videos. I'm like, look how you're, like, I can see it physically, but I remember how it felt. But as a baby, which sounds probably, a lot of what we're saying might sound different to some people, but I do remember that feeling. And also the, you know, it's interesting because we talk about ego a lot and being humble, but that feeling of like give credit where credit's due, I understand that too, because it has happened even in this lifetime where, you know, people want to make me small or quiet. And I have a kind of averse reaction to that. I mean,
absolutely. Well, that could be, you know, a very good reason for choosing to have that leader influence in your soul types as well, because, you know, you don't want to be kind of victimized by anybody. You do want to learn to stand up for yourself. You know, you're learning to be an empowered person when you choose something like that. Mm-hmm. I can give you, Michael, a best life as well.
Well, you enjoyed mine, didn't you? Yes, I see that smile on your face. Did it sound accurate to you?
The one thing about Monica is that it's interesting. She's one of three sisters, and her dad was always vocal about the fact that he wanted sons.
Sons. I mean, especially if I'm the middle one. The third one, he already painted the room dark hunter green carpet, and they wouldn't find out the sex of the baby. And then out came Jessica, and
you know, you see these sort of themes and these weird quirks and things. You know, you're always, the question is, why would you choose to come into that family? Mm-hmm. You know, and it might even be because a lot of the times you choose a family of origin. You choose your parents, and they choose you on a soul level, and it's often for these important lessons or opportunities to work through things. So because, you know, based on the past life, you're here to really learn to be you. This gives you something to push against. Mm-hmm. You know, like, you know, let's say your dad wanted you to be, you know, maybe do boy things or whatever. I'm not saying that happened, but, you know, if it'd been something like that, then it gives you that opportunity to use that as a springboard and go, no, I'm going to be, you know, who I am.
Yeah,
and,
absolutely. We believe that fully. It's definitely like that blueprint, right? That plan that we agreed to. You choose a family. I come from a Middle Eastern family with a lot of, you know, strong opinions about roles, female, male. You know, there's a lot of that, and it makes sense. Yeah. And I always pushed against it. I mean, hard, though. I was super clear of what I did not want to be, you know? So a lot of what, I mean, really everything you said is are things that I've thought about that absolutely are true.
So if you didn't have that leader in your soul types, it would be so easy just to sort of acquiesce or go into that, you know, people-pleasing mode or whatever that you've probably learned from, you know, previous lifetimes. This is really to sort of make sure you go, no, I'm going to be me. I'm going to do my thing.
That's interesting. And that's probably why some people, maybe if a newer soul, right, will feel held down or be a victim about it or just be sad and not feel like they have any free will or ability to be something else.
A victim of circumstance and, this is just the way it is or whatever. Yeah, but we've all got the ability to really change our circumstances. And that's the thing about the life plan. It's, you know, we're not helpless victims of this life plan. We can shape it, and we can, you know, we can work with it and adapt it and so on. We're meant to use free will and, you know, to do that. So, Michael, let's have a look at your past life. Both of you seem to have a thing about Northern Europe. This, I guess, is Portugal still considered Northern Europe? Anyway, Portugal. The first thing the guys talked about was you had a very difficult childhood with your father. He was very physically violent, beaten a lot by your father. You were meant to be a doctor, and this is one of the classic sort of thing coming into a family where either they were in the medical profession or maybe they just wanted a son who was a doctor. You, in this life, and again, this is fairly recent, this, you know, life before this, I'm sure, you wanted to actually get out into the world and make a difference a lot quicker. So you got involved in some sort of program. I don't know if it was through a church or whatever it was, but you ended up almost like a sort of mission type situation going to South and Central America. I'd imagine being, you know, Portuguese, probably went to Brazil, but I know also the guides mentioned Central America as well. You wanted to really help people, but you felt in that life that you wanted to do it more through a mission of exploration rather than a mission of examination, which you're doing in this life. The two look very similar. They make you a permanent learner. You know, you want to learn and grow, but the difference is that examination is about more, it's more cerebral, intellectual growth. exploration is about getting out hands-on empirical experience of the world. So that, you know, you traveled, you were experiencing new things, new places. The problem was they actually, you developed malaria. You had multiple bouts of malaria, and then one bout killed you. You didn't survive. So this has created a sense of unfinished business, that your soul feels like it needs to do a lot in this life to make up for the lost time. And it doesn't mean that you have to go back to South and Central America to do anything. It's not about repeating the exact experiences. But what it will do is give you an increased need for growth, especially through the mission of examination. So intellectual growth. An interesting thing about what you've both chosen, but particularly how it shows up with you, Michael, is the thinker-educator combination is the part that makes you very intellectual. It's going to push you to both be a learner, but also a teacher. You have to, well, both of you to some extent will be doing this, imparting knowledge. You can't hold it all in. It's not all just about, you know, your personal development. It's also about how do you help other people? How do you make a difference to their lives as well? There was something else that was showing up with you, Michael, and I just kind of lost it. Sorry, just one second. Senior moment. It was related to the thinker educator. Oh, yes. One of the intentions for this life is to spend a lot of time reading. And this helps to make learning enjoyable, but it also helps to focus on the written word. And so, you know, I have ADHD, and I have a thinker in me, but I don't have that combination. And I mean, I'll look at a contract, and by line two, I'm losing it. I can't focus. What you've set up by the choices that you made is to make sure that you can focus on the detail. And you see it a lot in lawyers, scientists, academics, anybody who's really sort of using, you know, much more the sort of left side of the brain, if you like. But interestingly, you both have a very creative aspect to part of how that shows up is a need for making your own decisions, you know, using creative thought. And I know it's a really weird one, and it doesn't show up 100% of the time. But what I have noticed when people die in a past life from something like malaria or anywhere where there's a fever, they tend to get very hot and cold at night. You know, they swing between throwing the blankets off and pulling them back on. So I don't know if you have that.
Yes, no, I get yes.
Yes. I also think I thought it was just that maybe I am a bit of a masochist. Like, I don't mind pain, or I almost find it, I'm gonna make myself sound super weird, but I have a high threshold for pain. And you really are so opposite of that. Like, you'll avoid pain no matter what, but maybe it's because of this.
Absolutely. No, it resonates a lot.
Like, you really, really, like anything that slightly might hurt a little bit, he'll avoid. So, right? I think everything
absolutely.
Sounds.
It resonates very much.
I didn't catch all of that. I do apologize.
Anytime he feels like something might be even just slightly painful, or like,
acupuncture,
like anything that if he thinks he might experience any kind of pain, he'll avoid it as long as possible. In a way that, again, I thought that I just had a high threshold, and I do, but based on what you're saying, it really is true. I see it in him a lot, and he gets very like inward when he even thinks about something painful. Like, he becomes almost childlike, I'd say. Not by
something like that would probably go back to an experience of torture in a past life, you know, pain being imposed on you. And it's going to, of course, again, the karmic pendulum, you're going to try to avoid pain in this life. You would know that you've been tortured because you would have that really strong, you know, don't tell me what to do, don't control me kind of thing. Any feeling of being restrained or trapped. There was an incredible story. Do we have time for me to share
a story
about that? I was working with a guy, actually, he had shared his experience with somebody who turned out to be a client of mine. And my client said, you know, it sounds like a past life issue. And how about I'll buy you a session with this McLeod guy over in Seattle. This person is over in Europe. And so I spoke to him, and his issue was that he was suicidal in his sleep. He would sleepwalk, but he wouldn't just sleepwalk. He would throw himself out of windows.
Wow.
And he had ended up, he's talking about ending up in a neighbor's yard. He had broken legs, arms. He had to tie himself down at night. And he's for business reasons, he'd have to sometimes travel or be on call. And very, very difficult, very challenging, and very frightening, obviously, to sort of wake up and find yourself with a broken leg, like two floors down. So he didn't want to do, he wasn't open to doing the work in normal sessions. So I just said to him, look, how about we just break this into, like, I don't know, 5-10 minute sessions, because it's really not going to take me more than 10 minutes to figure out what happened here. And if there's nothing else you want to know, then why don't you just go away, then give me a call, you know, in a few weeks, and we'll just do it in 10 minute increments. So what I found was that he had been tortured in a past life. He was a partisan in Norway during World War II. He'd been arrested by the Gestapo, and he was in a situation where he was tied down in a chair and being tortured. But in front of him was a window. And all the soul could think about was, if I could just break free for a couple of seconds, I could just throw myself out the window and end it all. And so I told him that and said, you know, off you go and give me a call back and tell me how it's going. So now at this point, he had tried everything. I mean, it's very common with past life work, you know, that people have, you know, big breakthroughs when they've tried everything. They've had exploratory surgery, you know, they've done everything they thought, and this thing works. So he, you know, the doctors were looking at a neurological thing. He thought it might be this, it might be that. He tried everything. He came back to me about a month later, I think, and he said, I'm 90% better. Or was it 80% or 90%? He's a scientific person, so he had kept meticulous records of, you know, of every incident and so on, for, you know, going back to childhood. So he said, let's say it was 80% better. And I just went, okay, well, that's good. It's not perfect, so let's do a little bit more work around it. And we just found a couple more details and sent him off. And next time I talked to him, he said he doesn't even keep a record anymore, because it just doesn't happen.
Wow. Wow.
And this is very typical of, I mean, although it's quite a dramatic story, but it's very typical of how the principles work, because the problem is that the soul doesn't die between lives. So your soul is always on life number one, even if you're on life 110. So it can't separate out but past lives very easily on its own. It has to be reminded. And the way it works is that if you find out what a past life is, you know, when I'm working with somebody, I just tell them, because I'm in the zone and I have no patience for regressions. You know, like when I first started doing this work, and I'd have somebody lying there going, oh, I think I see a house, I think I see a tree. And it's like, oh God, beat me up, you know, can't be doing that. I'm way too impatient for that sort of thing. So I just tell people, well, this happened to you, and that happened to you. And then they'd come back and go, oh my gosh, you know, my psoriasis is healed up, or I no longer have that fear of claustrophobia, or whatever it was. And all it is that the soul has to be reminded that was then and this was now. This is now. But you have to have enough detail that's accurate. You can't just say to the soul, well, oh, you got a problem? That was then. This is now. It won't know what to do with it. Like, you know. But if you say, start giving it a few just hints, like, you know, Portugal, Central America, malaria, it starts to go, oh, yeah, remember that one. And then just by doing that, it's like it releases the fears.
It's so interesting.
From that past life.
there was two things. A woman we knew, she would wake up every night and she would eat. She would open the fridge, the cupboards, eat, and she'd wake up in the morning with chocolate all over her mouth and her shirt. And nobody wants that, right? Not even enjoying anything you're eating. Then they started to lock the cabinets and they'd hear her shaking them in the night, right? In her sleep. So I'm sure that that is something past life related, but I also, it made me think about
starvation. Yes. Yeah.
Like eating disorders, right? I had anorexia in this life and I did get an indication in two people in different readings told me I starved to death in one of my lifetimes. But I wondered anyway, yeah, I think exactly, I'm agreeing with you. I think they're all different kind of clues, right? To direct us of where we need to go or what we need to let go of, right?
Absolutely. And honestly, you know, once you recognize that there's a system behind all of this, you know, as I'm describing in my books, that you can figure out for yourself what fears you're dealing with and then know what to look for. You can even do your own past life regression and once you see the system, it's actually very, very simple. I mean, there are 10 fears and then there's 10 phobias that are these death-related fears. And I did want to just go back to one just thing, Michael, and this is just a very general statement, and I'm not reading you here. It's just that when people have had a mosquito bite or a snake bite or spider bite in a past life, they tend to have a discomfort with having blood drawn or any kind of puncturing the skin.
Yep, that's true.
Bingo, ding, 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 ding. You can't tell you how, I mean, it's comical for me because it's, again, his reaction is not, it's not who he is, right? His demeanor today, his nature today is so strong. And but these kinds of things, like, yeah, completely.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, I came across as a client who's, we were talking about her daughter, and I said, oh, you know, your daughter was, I can't remember if it was a snake or a spider, but there's a puncturing of the skin. And I said, does she have a fear around, you know, having blood drawn or vaccinations or whatever? And the mom said, even as a little baby, getting her first shot, she would just pass out. And it was all going back to that past life of having had the bite. Yeah, fascinating. There's so much. I mean, I've often said it at live events and other places. I don't believe there's anything about we humans that isn't past life related. And I always say to people, challenge me, you know, throw out things, anything about human beings. I think that everything is related to past lives. You know, who you are, your fears, your concerns, all your talents are past lives. I mean, really everything about you is past life related.
Especially when you come across people that just hate you or you don't like, you have like an aversion to them right away, or, and it's based on nothing, you know, in this life, right? There's no history, there's no experience, or you were fine and then suddenly they hate you. Like, what happened? And I think it's all, I mean, again, I've seen different lifetimes with that too, with specific people. Well, one notable one. And once I got the story, I couldn't even be upset about the situation in this life because I knew there was going to be growth in it for me if I was able to see it that way.
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. We, and you know, we encounter so many people for lessons, you know, the spirit world is working all the time to make sure we meet people to maybe support us on our journey or to work on something together. Again, I think it's one of these things, I think if we were more aware of, you know, how things like reincarnation work, we'd value certain relationships more, and we would also avoid certain ones more, especially those ones where you get that spidey sense. That's your intuition, the voice of your spirit guides telling you, maybe I don't feel really good about this person. And how often do we have that negative feeling and then we override it intellectually? We go, well, I'm sure they're fine. And then 6 months down the line, you go, oh God, I wish I'd listened to my intuition. This person's a monster, you know? So,
well, that's a tricky thing because I really do trust my intuition and I do hear it and I keep hearing it more and more. But then the spiritual part of me is like, okay, even though I'm not feeling great about this person, they seem like they want to improve or they want to connect. So I'm going to be kind. It's an interesting where you're kind, but yet you need to protect yourself to say, okay, there's only so far I want to let them get in. But I want to ask you this one question. How would one go about raising that intuition? Like for me, sometimes I test it. I'll go in a room and I'll say, okay, where would this be? And I'll see what guides me and I'll get that. Other times I'll hear, it's like a thought, but it's not coming from my brain. It's coming from like behind my ear. I can't explain it. It's like not in my body. It just comes from there. And I know that that's intuition because it's always come true, those things. So I know when it's me or when it's something else, but how can I invite more of that?
Well, one of the first things really for anybody to do is meditate. I mean, you know, getting into an altered state is a really big thing. You know, I've talked about this a lot, about how we live in such a crazy world. You know, it's kind of noisy, it's hectic. And, you know, the classic thing is that people complain to me they can't hear their spirit guides when they've spent all day, you know, commuting, working, TV on, and so on. And they're, you know, for me, when I first started, you know, the whole thing I talked about at the beginning, when I first worked with my spirit guides, the key was tranquility. The first thing when I heard that psychic's voice in the room, it was like in a quiet apartment. And I just arrived like a few hours before. And it was a feeling of like, oh, I need to meditate. I'm really stressed out. And finally, I have the peace and quiet. And then I was, you know, everything sort of started opening up. And then being in a very tranquil environment with a houseboat, that was very, very helpful as well. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't have been so easy if I was still living in the center of London as I did, or the center of New York, just because you've got a lot of noise, distraction, and so on. I was actually fortunate that when I don't even know why I did it, but I mean, when I was about 30, I guess, I learned to meditate and went to a weekend seminar class. And it forced me, because I was super wired. I mean, I was like, you know, very kind of nervy and, you know, full on. And my life was like absolutely crazy, you know, like just, I mean, I never had any sort of downtime. And so I found that having the quiet, learning to meditate and being forced to do it by doing a class, and then applying that to the communication with the spirit guides, like always doing a meditation. And then, you know, and well, I bring them in first, but then afterwards I go, okay, like, let's make sure you hear and hear some questions and so on. But, I think sometimes people are looking for a little bit of a quicker fix as well. I know with a few clients, but you can't get around it. You need to alter your brain waves. You need to calm the whole system down. And meditation is the absolute key. But we can always do it differently. I mean, you guys with the leader influence in your soul types, you could meditate very well walking on a beach or something. You could go for a hike and you could be connecting, where it would be a little harder for somebody who doesn't have that aspect in their personality. So not everybody has to sit quietly hoping that they can calm themselves down. Sometimes you need a little bit of distraction, even doing a meditation with music. And when it comes to past lives, and this is really a big deal, often past lives of things like rape or sexual abuse, they create a fear of intimacy, and that's a heart chakra issue. And then how that blocks you from getting deeper is that you want to go into that sort of deeper place so you can connect with your guides. But what happens is you're trying to go down there deep, 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 and the soul, or well, the fear is telling the soul, hey, it's not safe, so it's pushing you back up to the surface. So years ago, I was doing a week-long workshop in Canada. The whole plan was to do, like, we would do something like a dozen regressions. And on the first day, there was these two holdouts. Everyone's having these amazing experiences and sharing with what they're getting. And I realized that I'd kind of, well, I'm not screwed up, but I should have been more aware that what both of them were dealing with was a fear of intimacy. And so the next morning we did the regression to go back and discover the source of the fear of intimacy. And it hit them so hard. One broke down, she's sobbing for like an hour, and the other one ran out and disappeared for an hour. I mean, it was like, and I'm having that moment where I'm going, oh, shit. I mean, is anybody in charge here? Oh God, it's me. You know, I've just lost one of my participants and the other one is having a complete meltdown. But they were completely freaked out because all this stuff had come up about sexual abuse, not only in the past life, but in the present life as well. But after working through that one, they were able to do regressions like everybody else. So I think it's an important thing. If there is a fear of intimacy, a heart chakra issue, then you probably want to take care of that first. And it's going to make every other communication, whether it's regression or just general communication with the spirit world, a lot easier.
Very fascinating. So, I mean, I've learned many, many things in this interview. Thank you so much for your time. I really, really appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for having me on the show. I really appreciate it. I always love just having the opportunity to talk about this. You can probably guess that I love my work and I find it endlessly fascinating and I love sharing it with other people. So thank you for giving me the opportunity.
Thank you.